here or in the probably in the MPPC hospitality tent. Anyway, thank you all for coming. Right now, I want to introduce Dr. Ron Prestige, who's MPPC's president, and he's going to give you some opening remarks. Ron?
Good morning. Welcome to MPPC's 27th World Pork Expo. We expect to have about 20,000 people here for Expo this year and about 400 exhibitors. In addition to that, there's going to be 900 entrants showing about 2,500 show pigs at the World Pork Expo Junior National Hog Show. We only had 300 entrants in that 8 years ago, so it's one of those events that's grown rapidly. Hope that you take the opportunity to go see how hard these kids work. We'll have thousands of producers from across several states and people attending from about 40 countries around the world. People have had will have the opportunity to hear about 20 different presentations and panel discussions on various pork industry topics. I'd encourage you to attend tomorrow's Strategic Investment Program lunch upstairs in the Varied Industries Building, where Iowa Governor Terry Branstad and USTR Chief Agricultural Negotiator Darcy Vetter will speak. I don't know if you've heard Darcy before, but she's very, very impressive. For Thursday's SIP lunch, we'll have a panel discussion on antibiotics, which, as I'm sure you're all aware, has been a very hot topic recently. Before I turn things over for a series of updates, you know, with different board members and speakers to answer questions for you, I want to mention a couple of numbers from NPPC. Good news is that NPPC is in a very strong position financially. Our revenue for the first 4 months of 2015 is up 11%. We've added an additional 71 new investors this year, which gives us over 3,000 total investors. And as I'm sure you're aware, NPPC is voluntarily funded by producers that that support our efforts. We, of course, are the voice for producers in Washington fighting for reasonable legislation and regulations, new markets for U.S. pork around the world, and protecting the livelihoods of our producers. Now we're here on the Iowa State Fairgrounds with all this beautiful weather that I brought with me from Washington last night. And I want to thank you very much for coming to Expo. If you need anything, contact an NPPC board member, Dave, Janice, Marlis Miller, any of the other staff, and they'll make sure that they get whoever it is you need to talk to as soon as possible. The NPPC board members, Howard Hill, John Weber, Ken Mashoff, and myself, that's embarrassing, will be available, and Jim Compart, those are the officers except for Jim, will be here in the media center from 3:45 to 5 p.m. this afternoon to do one-on-one interviews with any of you. And I think they've actually got me scheduled for some that are outside that timeline. And we'll also have CEO Neil Dirks, Trade Vice President Nick Giordano, Chief Veterinarian Dr. Liz Wagstrom, and Economist Steve Meyer available for you as well. We've got a very tight timeline for Howard to get to a meeting, and so I'm going to go straight to Howard, Dr. Howard Hill, our immediate past president, who's going to talk to you about our issues on trade.
Thanks, Ron. It's good to see all of you again. We truly do appreciate what the press does for us here, the good coverage you guys always give us every year. As Ron said, I'm the immediate past president of NPPC and chair of the NPPC Trade Policy Committee, and I'm going to be discussing some trade issues, particularly TPA, and I'll use that acronym, Trade Promotion Authority, TPP, like you all know what that is. Cool. And then also I'm going to talk about the Swine Health Information Center at the end. Steve, you keep taking those pictures and I get a buck for each one, I'm going to be rich. I'm sure that you all know our top trade issues right now are the Trade Promotion Authority, TPA, and COOL. On COOL, we're urging Congress to act quickly to repeal labeling provisions for pork, beef, and poultry so that we avoid trade retaliation from Canada and Mexico. The WTO found that COOL isn't compliant with international trade rules and soon will authorize Canada and Mexico to place tariffs on literally billions of dollars worth of U.S. goods, including pork. At this point, there's really no time to fix it. That's passed. We had a chance in the Farm Bill. We worked hard. We couldn't get it done. But retaliation will destroy jobs and negatively affect the U.S. economy, and it could come as early as August of this year. We don't need or want tariffs on pork exports going to our number two and number three export markets, Canada and Mexico. On TPA, NPPC is leading the agricultural community effort to get it approved. As you know, the Senate passed TPA 11 days ago, so we've turned our sights now on working through this with the House. We need TPA to finalize free trade agreements, which are vital to U.S. pork industry. Last year, we exported nearly $6.7 billion worth of pork, representing about 27% of our total production. And those exports added almost $63 to the price producers receive for each hog they sold. Of course, the biggest and most important trade deal which we need TPA is the Trans-Pacific Partnership. This partnership includes 11 Pacific Rim countries, including Japan, Mexico, and Canada, and those are our number one, number two, and number three markets. So you can tell why it's so important to us. TPP would be the biggest commercial opportunity ever for the U.S. pork industry, and we would boost the U.S. economy tremendously. If all tariffs and non-tariff barriers are eliminated in each TPP nation, more than 10,000 new agricultural jobs would be created in the United States, and U.S. pork exports would grow by 50% within the next 10 years after implementation of the agreement. Of all the TPP participants, Japan, Vietnam, and Australia have the most significant markets for increase for U.S. pork exports. Japan, of course, is our largest U.S. pork export market in the terms of value. In 2014, we shipped about $1.9 billion worth of pork to Japan. NPPC has worked hard to position pork producers for huge market access gains in Japan through the TPP negotiations, which I'm sure you've followed. Vietnam's estimated pork imports represent less than 2% of the country's total pork consumption of nearly 2 million metric tons a year. But U.S. pork exports, unfortunately, are limited by tariffs and non-tariff barriers. NPPC is pushing hard in the TPP negotiations to get those barriers eliminated. If we succeed, U.S. pork sales to Vietnam will increase by hundreds of millions of dollars, according to a prominent agricultural economist, who I won't mention, but his initials are Dr. Dermot Hayes. On Australia, this is an important $200 million market for U.S. pork because of the U.S.-Australian free trade agreement, and U.S. pork is the top U.S. agriculture export to Australia. However, chilled and frozen U.S. pork cannot be sold at retail in Australia, which maintains some non-scientific-based barriers that limit us to sending either processed pork, frozen pork, or boneless pork for further processing. NPPC is working in the TPP negotiations to get those barriers eliminated. While we're pressing U.S. trade negotiators to resolve the issues with Australia, Japan, and Vietnam, we've already achieved some TPP successes with a number of important markets. Chile and Peru agreed to eliminate trichina testing requirements on chilled pork based on USDA certification that the pork originated from PQA Plus farms. Those victories, coupled with existing FTAs with several South American nations, will help increase U.S. pork exports there. We've already grown by 500% over the past 5 years in South America. Malaysia, which has excellent potential for increased pork exports, had a de facto ban on U.S. pork products since 2011, imposing individual plant registration and inspection requirements. The country eliminated all of its non-tariff barriers. Another success. New Zealand, like Australia, restricted market access for U.S. pork based on unscientific concerns about the transmission of PRRS, but a risk assessment determined that the likelihood of transmission of PRRS is one case in every 1,227 years, and the country eliminated that trade-distorting non-tariff barrier. Finally, Singapore recently agreed to lift its ban on pathogen reduction treatments, which will reopen the market to U.S. pork. In addition to the TPP negotiations that have been underway, we have the Transatlantic Trade Investment Partnership, or TTIP as we refer to it, a free trade agreement between the U.S. and the European Union. To achieve the same outcome for U.S. pork with the EU that the U.S. has reached with all the other FTA partners, complete open trade, EU import duties on pork must be eliminated, and all non-tariff barriers, including SPF restrictions, must be removed. Furthermore, U.S. trade negotiators must reject any non-scientific-based proposals, such as animal welfare measures by the EU, that if implemented could act as a major impediment to agricultural trade. Another important trade matter involves South Africa, which maintains a de facto ban on U.S. pork through a number of, again, non-scientific-based barriers. We're at a significant disadvantage when it comes to gaining access to South Africa's large and growing market for pork, because that nation accepts pork from key competitors such as Brazil, Canada, and the European Union. NPPC is working with the U.S. and South African government officials to get that market opened. We also scored a victory on the International Food Safety Standard when the UN's Codex Committee on Food Hygiene agreed to a draft guideline on parasites in food, which encompasses trichinella in pork. Due in large part to NPPC's effort, the international guidelines will define negligible risk for trichinella, develop methods for monitoring the disease, and approve methods for testing, all of which will greatly increase confidence in the safety of pork. We expect the guidelines to be finalized in July at the Codex meeting. On another important matter, we're seeing things get back to normal at the nation's West Coast ports, which are vital to U.S. pork exports. About 60% of the U.S. pork exports are shipped on the water, and about 80% of that exit through those West Coast ports. So you can understand why that was so critical to us this last winter. In 2014, roughly 8.4 billion of U.S. meat and poultry cleared West Coast ports. That's more than $160 million a week. And as you know, from November of last year to February this year, there was that work slowdown by dock workers because of labor disputes between the union and the association which represents those port facilities. As a result of the slowdown, U.S. pork exports in the first quarter of 2015 were down 14% in value and 10% in volume over the same period of 2014. The cost of the slowdown to the U.S. meat and poultry sector was conservatively estimated to be in excess of $40 million per week. NPPC was very active in pushing to get the ports operating at normal speed, spearheading letters, and holding meetings with top labor and infrastructure officials. We remain engaged on this issue, working to construct methods to prevent similar situations from occurring in the future. Before I conclude the remarks on trade and COOL, I want to go back to TPA. Again, this must be approved if not only the U.S. pork industry, but the entire U.S. economy wants to move ahead. The importance of TPA is so great that for the first time in a long time, NPPC will key vote this issue. This means that we will communicate with all 435 House members that if they vote against TPA, we will tell the country's 68,000 pork producers, our allied industry companies, and the whole world that we will use that vote in making decisions related to our political contributions. Basically, we're going to hold their feet to the fire. I want to take just a few minutes to also talk about the Swine Health Information Center. I think most of you have probably heard about this if you've been to meetings this past winter. As you know, the Pork Board appropriated $15 million for this project over the next 5 years. It'll be a program that will be separate from the Pork Board. It'll focus on industry preparedness for disease challenges that could affect the U.S. swine herd. This is really an outgrowth of the fact and the recognition that we were ill-prepared to handle a disease like PED, which the government has termed a transboundary disease. I think our diagnostic labs, our veterinarians, our producers responded as well as possible, but we were not prepared. We did not have diagnostic capabilities. All those had to be developed, which was done very quickly. The center is governed by a board. It consists of two members from the American Association of Swine Veterinarians, two members from NPPC, and two members from the Pork Board. From AASV, Matt Anderson and Daryl Olson, and Daryl Olson is the president of the board. From NPPC, Bill Lucky and myself, and I'm the vice president of the board. And from the National Pork Board, it's Brett Kaysen and Mark Greenwood, and Mark Greenwood is the treasurer. And then we have four at-large pork producers on the board, Mark Schwartz, Mike Terrell, three, Mike Terrell and Matthew Turner. And the big news that I'd like to announce, and you're the first to hear it, is that Saturday we did an international search for the director of this center. And Saturday we made an offer to an individual who you're all very familiar with. And on Monday, that individual, much to our pleasure, accepted the directorship. And I'd like to announce that Dr. Paul Sundberg, who's in our midst, is our new director of SHIC. And Paul, if you want to step forward and make a comment, Paul asked me how I was going to introduce him, and I said, well, I'll just say that you're very passionate, you're full of piss and vinegar, and ready to go. So,
yeah,
congratulations. Yeah.
Just a quick comment. I'm really excited about this opportunity. This is an opportunity for the pork industry, unprecedented way to improve swine health in our country. And I'm really excited about getting this going. I'm thankful that I get the opportunity to help with that effort. I will still be at the Pork Board through the end of June, and we'll get this thing going in earnest the first part of July. So I'll be available outside and throughout the expo, and as will others on the board. So thank you.
Thanks, Paul. Because we didn't know whether we would be able to make this announcement, we were right down to the wire. Our goal was to have this person in place by expo, which we were successful in doing. We didn't have a separate press conference about it, but I'm sure you're going to have a lot of questions of Paul and Dr. Olson, and they will be available from 3:45 to 5 o'clock here, plus, like Paul says, he will be available throughout the whole expo. And with that, do we have time for questions? Yeah, I got a cart, man. That cart goes 37 miles an hour. I can make it. Any questions? Yes, sir.
Might ask on the West Coast port situation. During that slowdown, was there any product that was lost, or was it diverted to other places? Or?
Yeah. and I can't tell you how much was lost, but I did talk to some Packer representatives, and they had a product that they had to destroy. So how much, you know, basically they filled the freezers, but there's only so much freezer space. And, you know, some Packers, to maintain customers, especially in Japan, were actually air freighting some of the product. And I understand that was, I think, an added dollar per pound. So they were probably losing money on that product, but they wanted to maintain their customers as best they could. I don't know. Neil, do you have any other facts or figures on that?
I'm Neil Dirksen, CEO of the National Pork Producers Council, and we also have Nick Giordano and Courtney Nuff here from our trade staff. So they are much better versed than I am. But I will tell you anecdotally, the things I ran into with the people I was talking to, there were delays. In fact, I talked to one packer one day after the initial deal had been negotiated, before it had been talked about, and this packer was so pleased because they had frozen pork on rail cars that couldn't get unloaded, and he was pleased because he got notice that it had been taken off of the rail lines, and that then it was still being staged. So the only other anecdotal thing I'll tell you is that the reports we've had that things were backing up here. As Howard said, people were looking at freezer space, putting product in freezer space. But once things started to clear, remember, we had a big slug of product that had to make its way through the system to then give our customers internationally a big slug of product that arrived. So they were looking at cold storage space in their respective markets also, and it's taken some time to work through that. I think I've been hearing some stories that exports have been picking up, so things maybe are normalizing more. I don't know, Nick, do you want to make any comments, or Courtney?
From shocks like this in the future, because we're increasingly dependent on trade, but there's no silver bullet here. So there is legislation introduced in the Senate now on benchmarking at the ports. We're supportive of that, along with a whole host of other industries. Senator Gardner is introducing legislation to amend Taft-Hartley. We're supportive of that as well. Obviously, we believe in the rights of employers and employees to negotiate. By the same token, the situation was out of hand at the ports, and it cost our industry a lot of money, and it cost a lot of economic damage in a lot of other sectors. So going forward, we'll be looking at working in coalition with other groups to try and look at possibilities, options to avoid this sort of pain in the future.
You all know Nick, but Neil mentioned Courtney. I look at Courtney as an old hand, but for those of you that don't know you, how long have you been with us now? Over a year, right, Courtney? Courtney Nupp is one of our key staff members with Nick on trade, doing a great job. And I don't think Maria is in here, is she? Or Maria? Oh, give us that wave. There you go. She does a great queen wave. So, yeah, they're doing a great job for us. So, I think that's. We'll be around, like I said, at 3:45 to 5 to answer any other questions.
No, I don't need an introduction.
They know who the good guys are because obviously the good guys always wear black, right? You know, one of the most fun things that I get to do is make the staff nervous by going off script. Dave and the staff does a great job by preparing comments, make sure we have accuracy on what we say, and especially to the press, so their heart stops when I get up here, and I think it's a lot of fun. next topic that we're going to discuss is antibiotics. As you're well aware, antibiotics have been a very intense thing in the media for the past several months. This is not a surprise to me. I'm a little bit surprised that it took as long as it did for this to become as big an issue as it is. And I am going to actually go through all of Dave's points to make sure that I get everything that I'm supposed to say in. But let me just start with this point. You should recognize that NPPC and pork producers have led on an awful lot of issues politically in animal agriculture. And this is certainly one of them. Our PQA Plus program that we have today actually evolved from an effort that was started in 1999. And there's basically three legs to the stool, if you kind of break it down in a simplistic way, like a Southerner will. If I'm talking too fast, tell me, I'll slow down. And they are animal health, interestingly, which has a lot of effort spent on the importance of prudent, judicious, appropriate use of antibiotics, and the fact that there needs to be a VCPR, a veterinary client-patient relationship, in order to make the appropriate decisions involving antibiotics. This is not something that's occurred as a result of the recent attention to the antibiotic debate in food animals. This is something that has been evolving in place for the last 16 years by the leadership of NPPC. The second part of it is animal welfare, which we're all well aware of the stresses that all of animal and poultry agriculture have been under for the last several years in that regard. It also is one of the key legs of the stool for the PQA Plus program. And finally, environmental stewardship. You know, and I think I said at forum that 20 years ago, pork producers' primary challenge seemed to be environmental. Last 5 years or so, it's primarily been animal welfare. And here recently, the big stress points have been antibiotics. Well, I don't know if the leadership, my predecessors, had a crystal ball or what, but those were the three things that have evolved with an effort of continuous improvement. Environmental stewardship, animal health, animal welfare, the need to have the pros involved in making those decisions all the way back from when it all started in 99. So now I'll go on script so Dave's heart rate will slow down. We recognize and have always recognized the need to protect the availability of medically important antibiotics for animal and human medicine. And I've said this before, I'm going to say it again. Those of us in agriculture will never win, nor would it be prudent or smart to point the finger at our human counterparts, the physicians, in an effort to defend our use of antibiotics. The reality is we need to take an approach looking at one health and one plan, and indeed yesterday I spent 8.5 hours, I think, at the White House with a meeting of physicians, members from CDC, FDA, everything. I'm a guess, just round numbers, there were about 100 people there on the human health side, probably 50 of us, a lot of veterinarians, a lot of brain power in that room, looking at trying to cooperatively work together to try to face the issues and challenges of antibiotic resistance internationally in the world. This is not just a U.S. issue. NPPC, before this all came to a head, had already taken the position of encouraging producers to phase out the use of medically important antibiotics for growth promotion. Well, you're probably aware of what's called FDA Guidance 209 and 213. That's what they say. And a lot of companies have made statements saying, oh, we're going to eliminate antibiotics from our supply system, whether it's retailers, food companies, or whatever. Well, I got news for you. That will be the law at the end of 2016. So they can make those statements if they want to, but the reality is what they're saying is we're going to comply with the law. That was a position that NPPC took before that law was passed. As a matter of fact, yesterday was the actual final rule on the VFD, which is called the Veterinary Feed Directive, which means that you have to have a veterinarian write a script for any medically important antibiotics that are going to be used in feed or water, and I think it includes water. Does it include water? It does. It includes water for food and water, feed or water. Like I said, go back and look at the PQA Plus program and what our recommendations were, which, by the way, are backed up with on-farm assessments and third-party audits. And as you can see, we've actually led on this issue for a significant period of time. Those long-standing training and certification programs have worked to ensure that farmers and veterinarians use antibiotics responsibly, protecting the efficacy and availability of antibiotics for therapeutic and disease prevention purposes for the health and safety of animals in the food supply. And I thought it was interesting in the meeting at the White House yesterday that I expected this to be a little bit different, but really no one really ever challenged the fact that we as ethical caretakers of the animals in our care have a moral obligation to treat animals if they're sick. And the good news is there wasn't any pushback on that. They all recognize the fact that antibiotics have got to be used to treat animals if they become ill. We're also are continuing to support and encouraging others to join us in the effort to have veterinary oversight regarding all decisions concerning antibiotic use on farms. Like I say, the real issue, when you get right down to it, is really more focused in on antimicrobial resistance is the big issue, more so than anything else. We're working on many fronts to help address those important issues and want our customers to understand the safeguards that are in place to ensure responsible antibiotic use in pig farming. Farmers will continue to use antibiotics strategically, administered when pigs are sick, susceptible, or exposed to illness. We got no pushback on that yesterday. Farmers will only use antibiotics approved by the FDA to treat pigs and administer them according to label and dosing instructions. That's exactly what the PQA Plus program says. Farmers will work closely with licensed veterinarians on decisions about antibiotic use, particularly all therapeutic uses of medically important antibiotics in feed and water that require approval. As of yesterday, that's the law. During the decades antibiotics have been used in food animals, there's been no proven link to antibiotic resistance to antibiotic treatment failure in humans. However, we are working collaboratively to minimize any future risks. The pork industry embraces any measures that allows for the continued improvement, safety, and nutritional value of pork. In September last year, President Obama issued an executive order on combating antibiotic-resistant bacteria, or CARB. The strategy stressed the importance of preserving antibiotics for both veterinary and human medicine. It acknowledges that while it is uncertain if or how much antibiotic use in food animal production contributes to resistant infection in humans, it will be important for both human and veterinary medicine to take steps to curtail that resistance. In March, the action plan to implement the strategy was released. That strategy and plan are balanced, as evidenced by the interagency task force being led by the Secretary of Health and Human Services, Agriculture, and Defense. The CARB initiative supports FDA's strategy of discontinuing growth promotion use of medically important antibiotics, that's called Guidance 213, and moving all other uses of antibiotics to prescription, or VFD, which was the thing that was announced yesterday. These changes are still on track to be implemented by the end of 2016. It supports increased funding for research on resistance and alternatives to antibiotics and development of better diagnostic tests. Also provides incentives for development of new antibiotics for human medicine, and I would add that it would be very helpful if we had new antibiotics that were specifically for animals that are not used in human medicine. It asks for the coordinated surveillance of resistance in human and animal bacteria and of animal antibiotic use in human and veterinary medicine. The statistic that they kept throwing out yesterday, whether it's accurate or not, I'll leave you to decide, was that there are approximately 2 million cases in the United States per year of infections that are resistant to antibiotics. And of those 2 million infections, their estimate is that there's approximately 23,000 deaths. I don't know. Stresses for the need for international collaboration, since this is a global concern. The president's budget requested $1.2 billion to accomplish these goals, including increasing USDA, Agricultural Research Service funds, and the competitive grants program through the National Institute for Food and Agriculture. Dr. John Clifford, who's the highest ranking veterinarian in the U.S. government, or USDA, told us yesterday that he broke it out into what the component of that $1.2 billion was for agriculture, and it was $77 million. If you do that math, I'll do it for you. It's about 6.5%. I'm not impressed. There's also an increase in funding for the National Antimicrobial Resistance Monitoring System, which we call NARMS. These are all activities that we have been and will continue to be supportive of. New funding is being sought in the president's budget to collect better data on how antibiotics are being used in medical clinics and hospitals and on the farm. And we made the point yesterday that we intend to be as cooperative as we can be, but we would certainly like some assurances that specific and individual data is not leaked on antibiotic use, such as was leaked by EPA involving personal data on our producers. The other thing that I want to make sure that you understand is the cooperative effort that's being made between NPPC, the National Pork Board, AASV, the American Association of Swine Veterinarians, and what's going to be our new thing we call SHIC. I think we have to be careful with that acronym. The Swine Health Information Center. You know, all four of those entities, you know, I have absolutely no doubt will continue to do a fabulous job of cooperating without redundancy and duplicating the efforts that we have at trying to work on this issue and others. We feel strongly that the remaining therapeutic use of these antibiotics for disease prevention, control, and treatment are essential to produce safe food through the protection of animal health and welfare. Now, that's the way Dave says it. The way I would say it is, you know, you get safe food from healthy animals, and it's usually more efficient to try to prevent or control disease than it is to treat it. We will work closely with regulatory agencies to ensure that these uses are preserved. In spite of this, there are advocacy groups and legislators calling for additional actions. Instead of letting the processes underway have a chance to work, they want to declare them a failure and impose restrictions through legislation that are unlikely to have any positive impact on human health or provide an improved understanding of resistance. And you probably know who the person is that usually leads that charge, and that would be Mrs. Slaughter, who's a congresswoman from New York. And she has again introduced a bill that would make it illegal to use medically important antibiotics for growth promotion. But she also wants what she calls routine disease prevention to be banned. Bad idea. She's also introduced a bill to collect more data on antibiotic use. She basically wants it to be federal law that all antibiotic use is reported to the federal government, and it would require reporting this data to the FDA, which would not help us understand resistance and not provide an opportunity to benchmark. Collecting data on gross pounds of antibiotics used isn't meaningful. If each farm, veterinarian, or feed mill were required to report it, it would overwhelm FDA's ability to receive and analyze the data and would be time-consuming and costly for farmers, veterinarians, and feed mills. On the Senate side, Senator Feinstein from California has sponsored similar bills. NPPC is working with other commodity groups and stakeholders to ensure that these bills do not move forward. The changes that will result from the implementation of FDA policy and the CARB initiative are significant and legislating further action changes, especially those that have no basis in science, is not necessary. NPPC is supportive of the outreach efforts to make sure that producers and veterinarians understand the changes that will need to occur with the implementation of Guidance 213 and the VFD rule. We're supporting the research and producer education activities that you will hear more about in the pork checkoff briefing later this morning. We need to move forward as an industry to make sure that we're preparing for the implementation of Guidance 213 and the VFD rule. And I would point out that our biggest challenge is, you know, NPPC represents 68,000 pork producers in the United States. And it is a big challenge for us to make sure that they are aware of what the changes in the law will require. In my opinion, it will be something that will be most important and most challenging for small producers. You know, large companies and integrated systems like my family's business have staff veterinarians that, you know, they're the ones that handle those things and make sure that we stay in compliance. But some small independent that now has to comply with this stuff has got a different challenge than what a Prestige Farms does. Did I make it through them all okay, Dave? Wow, I can read. I've got time for, and Liz Wagstrom is here. Dallas is here. Questions for myself or Dallas? Yes, ma'am. Yes. Yeah, their bills essentially address the use of antibiotics in food animals. They believe that the use of antibiotics in food animals is what causes antibiotic resistance in humans. That link has never been established scientifically, and it's the wrong approach to use. The good news from the White House meeting yesterday, in my opinion, was that I think that the physicians and we basically were in two different silos, human health and animal health. And I think they have a little better appreciation now for the complexity of the issue, some of the things that have been misstated or misunderstood in the past, the fact that we need it to be a very scientifically based approach to approaching the problem for antibiotic resistance. You know, we call it a problem. You know, the reality is this is what's called evolution. You know, when they invented penicillin in what, the 40s or whatever, there were people at that time that said, you know, these bugs will, in an effort to survive, learn to evolve, and that's what we call antibiotic resistance. You know, this isn't rocket science. You ought to figure out that those bugs are going to try to figure out a way to survive, and that's exactly what they do. So you get around that by being very prudent with the use of them to try to discourage the speed with which that resistance may occur, and of course bringing new antibiotics to replace those that have had resistance problems developed to them. But their efforts have primarily been focused on their belief that the use of antibiotics in food animals is the cause of the problem with resistance in humans. And that's a false part on their part. You know, they missed the boat on that one, which is the reason we're opposed to it. Yes, sir. You know, again, I think the good news was the people that were there from USDA and FDA really did not believe that there was any great value to just the gross reporting, for example, by pharmaceutical companies of the how many antibiotics were used. I don't know if it was yesterday. I think it was yesterday's USA Today had a thing that said 80% of all the antibiotics used in America are used in food animals. You know, they don't know what that number is, number one. Number two, you have to recognize that if you're going to put an antibiotic that's mixed in tons of feed or whatever, there's a very small percent of the actual antibiotic in the that's diluted into a carrier that's then diluted in a lot of feed. If you're if you do the math wrong and you end up saying, oh well, there were these this many tons of antibiotics used, you got to recognize that, you know, the actual amount of antibiotics that's in a ton of feed is usually measured in grams. There's 454 grams in a pound, just to give you an idea. But that math doesn't make sense to the people that want to blame us for antibiotic resistance. It was my opinion that the leadership of FDA and USDA and CDC recognized that gross reporting in that way was probably not worth anything. So I'm optimistic that they will recognize that it would be better for us to say what antibiotics are being used for treatment and versus prevention, control, and treatment of antibiotics. And because of the fact that it's now at the end of 2016 going to be federal law, that's going to be scripted by veterinarians, my guess is that they'll probably ask veterinarians to play a role in that reporting on behalf of the producers. That's the speculation on my part.
Hi, I'm Liz Wagstrom. I'm chief veterinarian at NPPC. Just to follow up on what Ron said, the commodity groups are all with between poultry and meat groups, as well as milk, working very collaboratively to try to work with FDA and USDA to develop a system to look at how antibiotics are used, why they're used, perhaps even looking at outcomes and being able to have data that helps producers benchmark their use, that is data that doesn't say a gram of one antibiotic is equal to importance of a gram of another antibiotic. So it's a very complex, complicated system. So things we see like in the Data Act that Mrs. Slaughter has introduced doesn't get to any detail that would allow us to really understand the epidemiology of resistance or describe how antibiotics truly are used. And so while it's a difficult task, I would say that the commodity groups are very proactively addressing that task and working together to say what's going to be the most accurate data we can get that has the answers the questions that FDA and USDA would like to answer, and that we can do with the least amount of disruption or effort or expense on our veterinarians and producers. And so we're working on it. We don't have a solution yet, but it's definitely going to be a solution that we're going to arrive at that's going to be better for everybody involved than what we would see with that legislation.
Nope. Any other questions for Liz or myself? Man, y'all are easy. Who's next, Dave? Huh? Dr. Meyer? I'll let you introduce him.
Steve Myers is the president of Paragon Economics, and he's going to tell you how the pork industry is doing.
Steve?
Let me clarify one thing real quick. Many of you, I've been friends for a long time, and you've probably seen a few emails the last couple of weeks. I'd recently executed the sale of Paragon Economics to EMI Analytics, which is part of Agristats, Fort Wayne, Indiana. and I'm vice president of pork analysis for EMI Analytics now. So Paragon Economics is no more, I guess, is the thing. Or, well, it is, but they own it, and I don't. So anyway, so vice president of pork analysis for EMI Analytics. So questions? But let's talk about, probably ought to tell them a little bit before I have questions, shouldn't I? Nope, sorry, you got to ask the questions today. Let's talk about what's going on in the hog markets. Obviously, this first quarter of this year was disappointing as prices went down. It is our take that the real driver of that and the thing, the first domino that fell that caused that was the West Coast port situation, which backed some product up and really put domestic buyers of pork in a very advantageous position where they could kind of sit back and wait for the market to come to them. As prices began to fall at the wholesale level and at the producer level, there was a very strong incentive to speed up marketings. If you know they're going to be worth less next week, you want to ship them this week. And so that pushed hog numbers higher during the first quarter of the year as we kind of hurried these hogs to town. And we started dropping weights, which was the evidence that we were pulling hogs forward. That added to the supply situation. In addition, we had the added pressure of more weaned pigs than what we had expected to have over the winter because of a very mild, especially by comparison to a year ago, season for PEDV. Our calculations show we know that pig death losses were not zero, but they weren't very far off from that. If we look back to the December Hogs and Pigs report, the December through February litter size published by USDA in March was almost exactly the size that we had forecast if PEDV losses had been zero. And so a very mild winter on PEDV has added to the number of pigs that we have coming. And so we had large numbers of hogs forcing hogs out of finishing barns because we were taking them to much heavier weights. And so those weights have come down. It was kind of the perfect storm, and I know that term gets used too much, but every factor was really negative on the supply side for hogs and on the export demand side, and it pushed these prices down lower than what we ever expected them to do. Now, the March Hogs and Pigs report came out and told us what we already knew, that market hog inventories were up substantially over 7% versus a year ago. But we always have to remember that we were comparing to 2014, and that is a complete outlier year that is so outlier that we're probably not going to use any of the 2014 numbers in analysis. We'll just go back to the 2013 numbers and say that was an oddball, and so we're comparing to that to do price forecasts at this point. Said we had about 7% more market hogs. There were a few surprises in that report. The biggest one was that the breeding herd was only up 2.2%. Analysts had expected it to be up 3.5%. It was up 3.7% year on year in December. We know that the breeding herd is growing. When we talk to breeding stock companies, gilt supplies are spoken for well out into 2016 at this point. So we know there's more growth coming. The thing that I really thought coming out of the March Hogs and Pigs report, though, was that in spite of these larger supplies, we would start seeing some turnarounds on the demand side that would help us, and in fact we have. We've rallied these hog prices back up into the low to mid-80s. Hog futures have hit somewhere in the range that we thought, 84, 85 for the summer on occasion here recently. The opportunities for producers have gone from back in March. The futures market had losses of $6 a head in it. Now it's got profits of roughly $10 per head in it for this year. Every contract on the board right now is profitable relative to where costs are. And so we've seen a nice rally here back to about the price forecast that we had coming out of the March Hogs and Pigs report, which were pretty bullish relative to most analysts at the time. I felt like I was out on another pretty shaky limb there, but it certainly has kind of borne us out as we've gone through the summer. As we look forward, our big concern is certainly the rate of growth that we have. And the big risk issue out there is what happens to PEDV in the winter of 15-16. Paul and David and Liz have not given me any assurances that this has gone away yet. And in fact, if I talk to the veterinarians, they all start kind of kicking the ground and hemming and hawing and saying, well, it could be pretty bad again. They sound like a bunch of economists. So, which they always want to try to sound like economists, so I don't know why they have a problem with that. But, yeah, see, I shouldn't have said, are you guys done talking today? I'll keep hammering on you if you are. But still, so that's the risk issue going forward. We see robust growth in this herd. There was a lot of folks that hadn't really grown their operations for a few years because of high costs. This corn crop and bean crop are about as normal as can be as far as planting timing, as far as condition. Right now, my judgment is we're a decent rain in July and a decent rain in August away from having very large crops once again. And so feed costs are going to be low. Everything points to expansion. And we have this little scepter of packing capacity hanging out here. We're going to be okay this fall, even with our larger numbers than we had versus 14. But if we grow this breeding herd 2 to 3 to 3.5% over the next 3 or 4 quarters, by the fourth quarter of 2016, we're going to be needing 2.5 to 2.6 million per week spaces, and we don't have that many spaces. Now, our packers can run above their rated capacity for short periods of time. That's kind of a fuzzy number because they can work, a few more of them will work on Saturdays, some of them will work extended hours. So I think we'll get through 16 okay. It's going to be tight. Pardon me, 15. But 16 is going to be tight. And if we run in that 2.55 to 2.6 maybe million head for very long, it could have some real negative market impacts in 16. And the two new plants that have been announced, which are welcome announcements, but they're not going to be here in time for the fall of 2016. They'll both be online in 17. So a pretty good outlook. Nothing like 2014, but, Ned and I won't live long enough to see another one of them. We kind of hope, because obviously it was driven by the shortages of pigs caused by PEDV. So with that, I'm sure I've left out some things you want to know about, but I'll let you ask questions so I don't ramble too long. Chad. Avian influenza has not had an impact of any degree on the meat sector yet. It's had huge impacts on the egg sector. And we know that that's an important thing, and it's going to really affect the baked goods side because of this impact in the Midwest on cracked eggs and liquid egg products. That's where you're going to see it first. And but on the meat side, the only real thing that's happened on the meat side is we have lost about 2.5% of the turkeys that we normally have, and we are going to have some positive influence probably on ham prices as we go into the holidays just because there aren't going to be as many turkeys available this fall. That's the only impact that we've seen so far. The big thing, the big hammer that's sitting there on this market relative to avian influenza is, do we ever get it in a major broiler area? We haven't had that yet. In fact, the broilers that are in Minnesota, which Golden Plump owns virtually all of those, have still not been hit, even though they're kind of intermingled among all those turkeys. The one that really caused everybody to kind of start flinching was when we had the turkey break in Boone County, Arkansas. Because you start getting avian influenza into a major broiler area, then you've got a real hit. Now, that's a good case in point, though, of one turkey farm in Arkansas has stopped all of the exports, virtually all the exports of chicken out of Arkansas to Mexico. And so what have leg quarter prices done? They've gone from 40 cents down to 31. I mean, it's been leg quarters of tank because of that one state not being able to export. So, the nervousness here is what happens this fall when the birds fly back south, if wild birds are really the vector of this disease or a major vector, and they fly over Arkansas, East Texas, Eastern Oklahoma, which is a major concentration of birds. The other one is that how much of that's getting mixed around up in Canada, and then some of those birds fly back down the Atlantic flyway. And that one's the really scary one because you've got North Carolina, Alabama, Georgia, which is 4-2-1 on the rankings on broilers. So haven't had a big impact on meat yet. It will have some impact because of the turkey thing. The bullet that we're sweating is what happens on the broiler thing, especially this fall. Now, there's some evidence, and we've talked about it some, that, you know, one of the things we have here is broilers, because of their production cycle, they don't live very long. And there's some evidence that there's an interplay of this virus with sexual maturity and some of that in some of these animals. It's one of the reasons it hits turkeys, because they actually become sexually mature as they're growing. Broilers never live that long, and so we don't know for sure on that. That seems to help. I'd probably defer to some of the people that know more about the poultry industry, but this broiler thing is the one that's the thing we're all sweating. And I'll make one other point. While there will be some positive market impacts from the turkey losses, avian influenza is different than PEDV, because PEDV had no export impact. Avian influenza has export impacts, so it has very negative market impacts when export bans go into place. One of the reasons, you know, turkey thigh meat has fallen out of bed as well, because you can't export any product out of Minnesota. Okay, so there's a negative consequence of avian influenza that was not there with PEDV. PEDV's impact was generally positive, just because it reduced the supply of pigs. Yeah, Megan. Well, I think so. My price forecasts and the futures are pretty close, actually, for the rest of this year. And given where we are on cost, I mean, we're in the low 70s on cost. So, you know, about the only one of those futures contracts right now that wouldn't be profitable would be the December contract. And by December, I think we're going to be well down in the 60s on cost. I mean, we have a normal crop. Now, if it doesn't rain this summer, then all bets are off on that. But I think I think producers will be profitable, even on the cash market for the rest of the year. I would advise them to be taking some profit coverage on these hogs at this point, because I don't think it's going to get much better. I think they will be profitable this year. Yeah, Chris. Right, exactly. If you get this into major broiler states, right now Arkansas can't export chicken meat, okay? They can export some cooked product and processed product, but not raw product, okay? So if you get this into Alabama and Georgia and you can't export from there, these supplies will build up, domestic supplies build up very quickly. That's the big concern, is getting it into broilers and what happens to the export situation. Yeah. Yeah, about 20. Yeah, roughly 20. A little lower than our percentage, but not very much. We export about 22 or 3%. They export about 20. Now, the interesting thing on theirs is all net, because we don't import any. Okay, on the pork side, we import about 5 or 6% that offsets part of that. Yes, ma'am. No, because you don't, I mean, the East Coast is a big area. I mean, are you going to get all of it? I haven't done any number crunching to see that. I don't want to think about that unless I have to. It would not be pretty. Wow. They must have not had much coffee this morning. We'll be back.
And you will, Steve will be.
And I'll be around
this afternoon and Wednesday.
Yeah, I'll kind of be in and out today because I've got several other things I got to go around to do. But, you know, if you're hanging around down here, I'll be in and out, and I'll be glad to sit down with you and visit one-on-one. And I'll be around tomorrow, too. So if you miss me today, you can get me tomorrow.
And then tomorrow morning back here at 8:30, we got three more updates. Dietary guidelines, Borders of the United States, which is hot off the press, and mandatory price reporting. Thank you. Thank you.
What time do you start? 8:30.
Yeah. And Jim. I'll put Jim.
I'll be here.
Okay.
EMI analytics. Yeah, that's all right. No problem, David. Everybody, we're all back. Out of Fort Wayne, Indiana, Port of Action.